I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade crafts and vintage items. Rob started the company in 2005 while he was 25 years old, and Etsy has more than 1 million artisans who sell their items on the site. Welcome.
Thank you.
So prior to starting Etsy, you were living in Brooklyn. You were a woodworker and furniture designer. What kind of furniture and woodworking did you do?
I was doing a lot of different stuff. I had a line of what I called 2x furniture, where I was using 2x4s and using some intricate joinery and making these rustic-looking tables. And prior to that, had taken this long path of just doing everything from demolition to sheetrocking, so learning my materials.
How did you first get introduced to woodworking and working with your hands?
Through my dad, who he started his own company in architectural specifications when I was growing up, and he was the person who picked what materials things were made out of, so all these companies would always send him free materials to try and encourage him to specify them in the buildings. And so I just grew up with tons of free samples of tile, and I remember a piece of bulletproof glass with a bullet shot in it, and was making things out of it. And then combine that with a kind of natural curiosity and desire for self-reliance, and you just basically start making things.
You mentioned self-reliance. Was that the culture of your family growing up, where that you would make a lot of the things that you would use?
I think that actually grew out of this idea of laissez-faire parenting that leads to self-reliance, because my parents just kind of let me go. And lacking that direction, you realize you can create that direction for yourself.
Did your parents consciously want you to just have the freedom to do what you wanted, or they were distracted by other things that might have caused that laissez-faire approach?
I would love to ask my parents that question. My dad was at work a lot, and I didn't see him all that much. I don't know. A lot of the schooling that I went to was just standard public schooling, and I really couldn't fit into that. And so I was challenged at a really young age with either getting kicked out of class all the time or trying to make something hold my attention. And that type of process led me to see the world as I wanted to see it. So I would try and change it to fit me because I knew I couldn't fit into it. And that led, you know, when I was older, to seeing psychiatrists and getting prescribed, you know, Adderall and things like that, which never interested me.
What's an example of things that you tried to change to fit or be more aligned with your yourself?
Sitting in a desk with a textbook in front of you was something was very difficult for me, so I would ask the teacher if I could, you know, sit on the radiator. I remember this from like 6th, 7th grade, going back even earlier.
What did they say?
Some of them would say yes.
So what are other examples? What else?
Not being able to keep my mouth shut, getting kicked out of class. I remember being really young, and I'd gotten kicked out of class, and I was standing in the hallway, and the principal walked by. And this is in elementary school, and I still remember this so clearly. And he said, "What are you doing out in the hallway?" And I really quickly said, "We're playing a game, and I'm supposed to be standing out here while they do something." And then I go back in and just kind of said, "Okay," and he kept walking.
And what part of all of this existing outside the mold was just kind of stimulating for you, and you kind of got a rise out of being a troublemaker?
I hope I wasn't trying to be a troublemaker. I hope it was just me being me. One of the things that's really difficult for me is I notice far too many things. Like, I see a lot, so it's always like I have this type of sensory overload and I have to choose what to focus on. And I've always thought attention deficit disorder is the exact opposite. It's more like attention excess disorder, where you're trying to pay attention to too many different things and then you can't focus.
You mentioned that your father worked in architecture. What about your mom?
My mom has been a teacher since I was really young, and more specifically teaching kids with behavioral disorders.
So how did she feel when she thought her kid had just that?
It was interesting. She kind of passed me off at one point to, you know, to the professionals to see, okay, well, you know, I remember being 16 in this pivotal moment of discovering photography and probably smoking pot for the first time, just really opening up these different paths to creativity for me. And, you know, at that point, I was going into the city and Boston all night and taking pictures at night. I was doing a lot of night photography, and I would come home and I would pass out. You know, the tea in Boston, the last tea is, you know, probably around midnight.
The tea being the subway.
Yeah. So I would go in on the last tea, and I would walk around, and then I would come back on the earliest one, come home, sleep for an hour, and go to school. And I would go to school, and sometimes just cut all my classes and go sleep in the photography room. And then I would come home from school, fall back asleep, and get ready for another night out. And all my mom saw of that part was me sleeping all the time. And so she said, well, you must be depressed.
So she said, you must be depressed. Did you feel depressed? Were you like, oh, she must be right, she's my mom? Or was she? Or did you think, oh, she just doesn't know that I've been out?
When you're 16, I think you, by default, think everything your parents say is wrong anyways. So initial reaction wasn't to say she was right.
Sitting here with you, you seem a little bit soft-spoken and demure and well-behaved. It's hard to believe that you were kind of a miscreant or a maverick growing up. Have you always had this same disposition?
No. This has been a big change. And I remember, you know, nicknames from being a kid all had to do with me not being able to shut up or sit still. And there's a lot of patience that you learn in starting a business and working with other people. And it's also just adapting yourself to what's around. And I'll point out this is a pretty quiet and demure place. Mm. So I feel that way. But yeah, when the company was just me and two engineers working out of my apartment, there was more screaming with those three people than there was in the company of 200 cumulatively across that entire company.
Your parents divorced when you were in high school, and you went to high school outside of Boston in Newton for 2 minutes, and then you dropped out.
I made it up to the beginning of my junior year and then just discovered photography and stopped going to classes. And also got a job. My mom dropped me off in town and said, don't come home until you have a job. And I was a cashier at Marshall's. It was my very first job during the Christmas season. I think I was the only person under 60 working there. And that was a great experience, because I think a lot of how you learn what interests you is by learning what doesn't interest you. And getting that window opened really early on was helpful.
Did you feel unconditional love from your family while you were going through all this hardship?
No, there were times in there where, I mean, my parents' divorce was really tough for me. And there was a time where I wasn't really speaking with my mom. And I left home and went and lived with my uncle in South Boston. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was just me discovering who I was. And I think I was so intent on that exploration that I naturally cut my ties, you know, my really close ties with my parents there. Mm-hmm. And it's been a fun journey where you realize how you can get deep into something that you really care about and that can take you away from these other relationships that are really important. I saw my dad do this in my parents' marriage, where, you know, he focused on work to the point where, you know, my mom didn't feel loved. And I've definitely caught myself doing that with my work. You know, the girlfriend that I had when I started Etsy, you know, left me about probably 8 months into starting Etsy. And there's this balance, and you really have to decide what you care about and what matters most at that moment.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade items, including furniture, jewelry, and clothing. So here you are in 2005, 25 years old, living in Brooklyn, trying to make a life being a woodworker, furniture designer. How did you come up with the idea for Etsy in that moment?
I graduated from college, my fifth college, and had that BA and kind of held it up and said, all right, well, time to go get a job. And seeing what doors that degree opened for me was a huge disappointment, where I saw people who were a year older than me who'd spent all of this time studying literature, and the jobs that they were getting were a notch above or alphabetizing filing cabinets at a publishing firm. And I wanted to do something that didn't waste this incredible education that I felt like I'd received and created for myself. And knew at that point that if I just went to work for some other big company, I wasn't going to be able to realize that. So started my own company with woodworking and said, okay, well, I'm going to make furniture. And I was making these couture computer cases. I was making wooden computer cases and looked for the best way to sell those, and looked on in the offline world. And there's consignment, there's wholesaling, and neither of those were really my cup of tea. I looked at the online world, and neither of those really worked out. And so that was on the back burner. And then the magical moment happened when I started working with Jean Rayla, who was the creator of Get Crafty. And she's an amazing person. I met her through a professor at NYU that I knew. I was starting a web development company as way to learn in one sense, where I didn't know anything about making websites, but I felt like there was something magical about that medium. And she asked me to help her rebuild Get Crafty. And that was my introduction to designing websites and then also building something that's helping communities organize and helping people communicate. And the community there was definitely crafters and a lot of them women who were doing their crafting as a hobby and looking to sell some of the stuff. And I was looking to sell my own furniture, and so that idea percolated, and I talked with Jean about adding a marketplace to Get Crafty, and she said, and I probably agree with her, that it would probably be better to start the marketplace separate instead of doing it inside of Get Crafty, because Get Crafty was really just a, you know, community of people talking. So one thing led to another, and the idea of creating the marketplace as a marketplace took birth.
What, by the way, was the name of your furniture company?
The same as the name of the marketplace. I actually still have my very first business cards where it says Etsy and there's a picture of this plywood table that I was designing on the card. I just found that when I was packing stuff up.
You came up with the name Etsy. It was inspired by a Fellini film called 8 and a Half. What's that story?
There's a scene where Guido's having a flashback to his childhood and there's a painting on the wall. And if you say this magic phrase, Asa Nisi Masa, the painting comes alive and looks at where this hidden treasure is. And so for me, it's just that idea of a magical nonsense word that when you utter it will reveal hidden treasures.
At what point did Etsy go from a vehicle for selling your furniture to your sole endeavor? Like, wow, I'm going to focus all my time on this and forget the furniture thing.
When I initially started Etsy, my thinking was I'll build the marketplace where I'd like to sell what I'm making, and then I'll get right back to making these things, and I just need the right venue to sell them. And another component to that was I was trying to set up my own e-commerce shop to sell what I was making on my own, and it was this lonely little website on the vast internet, and I'd seen the power of community working with Get Crafty, and there was another site called Craftster. And I wanted that community to bolster the marketplace. And, you know, I looked into things like CSA, community-supported agriculture, where you have a model of commerce that if it's just the kind of straight-up capitalism where its values are based on price and convenience, then in some cases it actually just won't work. There's a great documentary I just watched called The Real Dirt on Farmer John, and he was trying to make his farm successful. And the farm wasn't successful until he adopted that communities supported agriculture model. So that was in the back of my head as well, where the community component to it would be central to making the marketplace work.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, founder of Etsy. We'll hear more from Rob coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade crafts and vintage items. Once you launched Etsy with two of your friends from NYU, did people come immediately? Talk to me about those early days.
Yeah, it was amazing. I remember just launching the website, and one of the beauties of the web is you just push a button and it's globally accessible, so you're just kind of sitting back wondering who's going to discover it. And we'd spent an arduous 3 months building it, so we launched it and then just went out to dinner, came home, and I think fell asleep, and then in the morning woke up and saw that a couple people had registered but no one had put any items up. And then someone opened a shop, someone lists a couple items, a couple days go by, someone bought one of the first items, and that is one of the most amazing feelings, to see something go from nothing to all of a sudden you're connecting people, you're helping people sell things.
What were some of those things that people sold in the, you know, first day, two, three, four, week?
I remember buying a crocheted cat toy with catnip in it, and that was one of the very first items listed. And crochet and knitting have always played a kind of central role to the identity of Etsy. I used to tell people that the name was an acronym for everything takes some yarn.
And you had three cats at the time.
Yeah, I was working at an animal shelter, and just those cats that no one else wants. I'm a sucker for taking those home.
Did you purposely buy a lot of the items from these craftsmen in the early days just to give them kind of this positive feedback that, oh, yes, this site works?
I wish I could have done that. I was broke. I was working for my landlord to, you know, kind of not have to pay rent, and was buying what I liked and what I could afford at the time.
Did you list your own furniture on the site?
Yeah, I listed one of my computers and...
Wait, you're one of your computers or computer cases?
I mean, it was a full functioning computer. Like, I put the guts in it. I wasn't, you know, soldering any of them, but I was assembling the components. So you'd push a button and it would turn on and it was a working computer.
So you put one of your computers on Etsy and what happened?
I charged what I put into it, basically not making any money, but it still meant the thing cost around $1,000. And so, especially in the beginning, it was mainly the lower price items that were selling. So I put it up and it worked great for press because I guess it was a noteworthy design. And so that got picked up. And a lot of that early momentum comes from people writing about what you're doing. And that's been one piece of advice that I've always given to Etsy sellers asking how to be successful is make things worth sharing and worth talking about.
You mentioned you had friends who helped you launch the site and you'd have screaming arguments with these colleagues from NYU.
I would call them loving arguments. And that was Chris McGuire and Chaim Shopik. And still have a lot of love for those guys. That was just us in some ways not even knowing what we were getting into. But I remember one time sitting down on the couch with them and kind of putting my arms on their shoulders and saying, what we're about to do is incredibly difficult, but the only reason we have this opportunity to do it is because of how difficult it is. If it was easy, it would have been done, or other people would be doing it better than us right now. Mm-hmm. And going into that together, that type of camaraderie, I think that you have both sides of things going well and things not going well. It's kind of like I've heard some people say when a couple stops arguing, it means the love's gone out of the relationship, where there's always both sides of that.
So people trickled in initially. When did you start getting traction where you thought, wow, you know what, I have something here? Was it a specific person who bought something, or was it just the volume of people who bought something or sold things?
So to me, I've always measured success for Etsy on making other people successful. So early on, looking at how we were measuring that, it was more what people were talking about in the forums, which became the central place to communicate.
What's an example of that?
There are stories of a woman whose kid was really sick, and she was spending a lot of time in the hospital, and she'd been getting really depressed, and she started selling what she'd been knitting, and that gave her this new motivation to knit more. Turning her hobby into a business coincided with, you know, her son being in the hospital and getting better. And you learn about all of these things. And having visibility into that, to me, is this huge motivator. And that's the beauty of the web, is all of these serendipitous connections that can happen.
Your grandfather helped you in the early days. Your grandfather had worked at IBM. What kind of help did he provide?
He was a good sounding board, and a lot of his advice I didn't take, for doing the basics of the business side. And I've never been strong in finance, and I've never been strong, you know, even writing the traditional business plan that he was looking for. And the earliest fundraising that I did with Etsy, which to me is the most meaningful, was going to people who I'd built things for and saying, here's something that I'm building, would you like to support it? And those were people who, above everything else, were investing in me. They didn't need a business plan. And, you know, my grandfather was much more used to things at larger companies. And I remember the first investment we got, he said, why would anybody give you money? And then he met with that investor, with Spencer, who's a great guy. And the first thing he said to Spencer was, how would you feel if Rob lost all of your money? And Spencer said, it would sting, but okay. And for my grandfather, that was the prerequisite for letting him invest.
So who was Spencer, and why did he give you money?
Spencer,
and how much did he give you?
Etsy's first two investors were Spencer Ain and Sean Meenan, and then Spencer's brother Judson also invested. I met Spencer because I remodeled the bottom floor of his duplex and built him a bar. He lives above Tower Records on Broadway. And I met Sean because he was opening up Habana Outpost across the street from my apartment where I started Etsy in Brooklyn. And he needed some computers and he wanted to give the whole neighborhood free Wi-Fi. So I remember hanging over the side of his building, installing an outdoor wireless antenna. Those are the types of relationships where once you've formed that, you know, for Spencer, it was, okay, well, you built this bar and I've worked with you. And for Sean, it's you hung over the side of a building for me. And they both ended up investing $50,000 early on.
At what point did you say, you know what, I'm going to need more capital than just, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 for this?
I wish we had that type of choice. You know, thinking back, there's a lot I'd like to have done differently about those early days. We hit these walls where we had to scale the site for growth and we had to go buy hardware, and things like Amazon Web Services didn't exist back then. So I remember the engineer I was working with just saying, we need 20 grand in 2 days or the site's not going to come back online. Those were the walls that we hit where it was really capital intensive and had to go out and raise more money.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade items, including furniture, jewelry, and clothing. Etsy cuts out the middleman by connecting buyers directly with artisans who sell items ranging from clocks to knitwear to guitars. Rob started Etsy in 2005 when he was 25 years old. In addition to the early angel investors, who were some of your allies in the early days?
Soon after I launched Etsy, I wrote a fan letter to the founders of Flickr, Katarina and Stuart, who were heroes to me, just asking for their advice. Flickr, the photo sharing website currently owned by Yahoo, and they invited me out to San Francisco and made the rounds out there. They were super helpful. This was back in 2005, so before there were really any web startups in New York City.
Why were you so entranced by Flickr?
The craftsmanship of what they'd built and the sense of community around it. And that was one of the first websites from a design perspective to just cut away all of the cruft and just show the content of the page. And I was spending a lot of time designing Etsy, and that was a big influence on me.
What did you ask for in the letter, if anything?
I wrote them a letter the way a kid throws a penny off a building, you know, not really expecting any kind of reply. And I think it took a couple tries, but Stuart got back to me first.
How did they help you?
First, it was just, you know, there was this world that I knew nothing about. You know, I'm someone who just was meandering my own path out east and then, you know, went to visit them in San Francisco and went down to the valley. And Katarina up front was helpful just kind of saying, here's what I think is good about this world and here's what I think is not so good about this world, and making a lot of really good introductions. And, you know, there was a brief period of time where I was thinking of moving the company out there, but I'm an East Coaster at heart. I need winter and seasons, and so knew that I was going to keep the company in Brooklyn.
At some point, they introduced you to Fred Wilson, who runs Union Square Ventures, a leading venture firm in New York City. How did that encounter go? You said that you were starving for capital, so was venture capital the road you wanted to take?
No, initially we were just looking to do a small angel round, and one way that I've grown the company since the beginning has always been basically take what you need and no more, and spend what you have and no more. Again, this is my grandfather's good influence on me. So, you know, we were going to raise, I don't even remember the amounts, you know, probably $250,000, and we were wrapping that up, and Katarina said, we'll just go meet with Fred, and I had a dinner with him. And for me, and maybe this makes me old school, I don't know, but a handshake will mean more than a contract, and, you know, looking someone in the eyes and connecting with them means more than a term sheet. And found both of those things with Fred, where had a good reputation and definitely understood from a product perspective what we were trying to build. A lot of people at that time, I remember, like, when eBay was starting, people looked at Pierre and said, people won't buy things over the internet. And with Etsy, a lot of people thought, oh, crafty, handmade things, tiny market, that kind of thing. And for me, this was building something that was going to change the way the world's economy worked. Mm-hmm. And he definitely got that. So there was that connection.
When you launched the company, you were the founder and CEO. Since then, there have been some other CEOs that have come and gone, from Maria Thomas, who incidentally was a former employee at NPR, and most recently, Chad Dickerson, who was the CTO of the company, the chief technology officer. And in between Maria and Chad, you were again the CEO. That implies a certain level of turbulence. What's the story there?
So I was the CEO for the first 4 years and knew that there was this swath of business acumen that I didn't have, and in some ways wasn't passionate about. You know, I knew what I was passionate about, which was much more on the product side and the customer support side. So, you know, I was always honestly trying to do what was best for the company, and so that first shift was me stepping aside saying, I think this is what's best for Etsy. And so I said, I'm going to focus on the product stuff and you get to run the business, and tried that out for a while, and that didn't end up working out. And then when I came back, same thing. I said, okay, well, here's what my original vision was, here's what I think is happening now, and I want to return to that.
How do you feel now not running the company?
It was amazingly painful to go through. I mean, the emotions, it's not quite as bad as having your heart broken by someone you love, but it's also losing your life's work, and for me, losing 6 years of work in one fell swoop. And I lost all of those connections to, you know, the company was 200 people, and those are people I really, really loved collaborating with, and I lost all of that in an instant. And I think in some ways that's just like being in love and having your heart broken, you know. Sure, you put your heart back together, but you remember that it was broken.
Did you understand why the investors no longer wanted you to be CEO? Or was it going through like anger, denial, you know, those...
Denial, anger. Yeah, that's very accurate. And you traverse them. I mean, they were doing what they thought was best for the company.
Right.
You know, Fred Wilson wrote a blog post about my lack of management skills. And my biggest regret about all of it was I wasn't given the chance to take their feedback and learn from it. And I'm actually the type of person that really likes criticism. You know, it's going back to art school where you have crits and people come in and they really challenge you about what you're doing. And to me, that's how I get better. Mm-hmm. And never really got that level of criticism from the board so that I could get better. And when I did get the criticism, it was, here's our criticism of you, there's the door. And that was the hardest part for me.
Our producer just told us that it's the Kubler-Ross model of grieving. So denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
I skipped the denial part. And in some ways, I skipped the anger part. And then that came later. I may have to revise this model. For me, it was I felt sorry. And in a way, I wanted to apologize to Fred for what I felt like was letting him down. This was someone I'd been working with for years at that point, and on the one hand, have earned him probably around a 50 times return on his investment. But on the other hand, felt like, you know, when you're taking people's money, you're making a pact. And that understanding that I had with the earliest Etsy investors, with Sean Meenan and Spencer and Judson Ain, was that you did right by me and I'm going to do right by you. And we definitely had disagreements along the way. I think Sean at one point threatened to punch me in the face for something I was doing that he thought was really wrong. But throughout those relationships was always given the chance to show that I could learn. And so it went from that feeling of being sorry to that feeling of being treated unfairly and this realization that, hey, you know, I generally live my life by treating other people the way that I would want to be treated. And this is a way that I wouldn't treat someone else. And so that led to confusion. And then those give way to anger after that. I remember going home and going to the beach just to, you know, try and clear my head and just sobbing. And that's still there. You know, you don't ever get over that.
What have you bought on Etsy most recently?
A rocking chair and, I mean, gifts for other people. But also, to be honest, haven't done that much shopping on it since I got the boot, just because it's like going back to your old neighborhood where you got beat up.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing now?
I'm having a kid, and a big challenge for me is build the educational experience that you would want your own children to have. And so I'm starting parachutes.org up in Hudson, New York, and I'm going to be starting a school.
What kind of school?
Unlike any other school that has ever existed, it'll be a one part trade school where, you know, how do you understand what your avocation is? And then one part vocational training where here's how to make a living doing what you love.
What ages?
My preference now is under 7 and over 70, so to have this really interesting juxtaposition of younger people and older people.
What was the impetus for moving to the Catskills from Brooklyn, even though you still have a place in Brooklyn?
I have family from up there, and also thinking about starting a family of my own. I would much rather do that in a place where you can have a better connection to the land and your food and the local community there.
By the way, you look at all these entrepreneurs and CEOs of, you know, all these companies. Do you see yourself in anybody?
Sure. I think there's the obvious answer, which for me, I am a perfectionist when it comes to product, and I make a lot of my decisions based on intuition. But having just read his biography, I'm nowhere near as much of an asshole as Steve Jobs. But for me, it's been more about people who have this supreme respect for their craft. And so George Nakashima, and I just read his book called The Soul of a Tree, people who value craftsmanship. And to me, this idea of what handmade means is a value and a respect for making things with your own hands. And for people who haven't actually made things, it's very hard to convey the importance of that. And it's like if your house is on fire and you can only rescue a couple things, what do you take? And it's those items that have stories. Mm-hmm. And so I want to surround myself with things that can tell stories.
What does your home look like?
I just found this book in a bookstore titled Handmade Modern, and I was like, wow, that's my aesthetic. So I like the cleaner lines of modernism, but I can't stand the blankness of the materials that they use. And so I like everything from, you know, hand-hewn wood beams to using lots of reclaimed materials. They have, you know, I have flooring that used to be beams in a factory in Pennsylvania, and, you know, tabletops that have been made from bridges, and these things have previous lives, and that you're working to restore some of their utility after they've moved from one thing to another.
Your wife's name is Layla. How did you meet her, and what does she do?
She designs and makes clothing, and for a lot of musicians, she was working in the same building that Etsy was in, Etsy's first office building. I was learning how to sing and play guitar, and I'd spent about 3 years getting over all of the bashfulness around what it takes to perform for other people. And there was this really cool back stairway in the building that was all concrete, so lots of reverb. And I invited her up one night and got up the gusto to sing to her, and I was like, well, this is either going to end things really quickly or maybe something beautiful can come of it. I guess it went okay. We got married.
What did you sing to her?
Some early traditional stuff, some Bob Dylan stuff, some like early Jim James solo stuff before he did My Morning Jacket. And I was composing my own songs at that point, too.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy.
Coming up, we'll meet Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Gave her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Don't think twice, it's all right. Well, so long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I cannot tell. Goodbye is too good a word, babe, so I'll just say fare thee well. No, I ain't saying you treated me unkind, you could have done better, but I don't mind. Just kinda wasted my precious time. Don't think twice, it's alright.
Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital invitations. Users can choose all the design elements of a card, ranging from font to color, pattern, size, and Paperless Post has delivered more than 60 million invitations and cards since its inception in 2009. Alexa started the company when she was 23 years old with her younger brother, James. Welcome.
Thank you.
How would you describe what Paperless Post is?
Paperless Post is, it's a website that you go to and you can design anything that you'd buy in a brick and mortar stationery store, except that you send it all online. Once you've designed it, you put in your recipients' names and email addresses. When you send it to them, they receive it in their inbox and you can track their RSVPs. And I think the key difference between us and other online invitation companies is that it really looks like what you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, from the texture of the paper stock that the invitation appears to be printed on to the envelope with the receiver's name on it that shows up in their inbox and the animation for the more formal cards.
You co-founded the company with your brother, James. How did the idea for the company originate?
It was the result of a series of conversations that James and I had about various things that we wanted to do together. In the beginning, it was that we wanted to work together on a movie, on a film. So he would be the director and I would be the writer and producer. And then I had an idea for another company where it would be, it also involved the internet and a mass customization tool where people would design their own suits and they would get made in Vietnam and in Hoi An and then get sent to the U.S. Neither one of those panned out, but we kept talking and James called me one day and had this idea. He said, you know, I think that if this were available, people would use it, and I think that they'd probably pay for it too. I remember responding and saying, I think that you're right that people would use it. I don't know whether they'd pay for it, but I think that we should do it.
Your brother was at Harvard, where you also had graduated from. Do you know how he came up with this idea at the time?
He was actually planning a birthday party for himself. It was his 21st birthday. He'd ordered palm trees, little mini palm trees for $5 each, and printed cups that said Beach Club. You know, it was in the middle of winter, but it said Beach Club on them. But then when it came around to actually inviting people to the party, he really didn't have very many options because it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks away and he didn't have people's home addresses and he didn't really have enough money to spend on printing invitations. But at the same time, he didn't want to use Evite or email, which wouldn't express how cool he knew the party would be. So it was actually out of his own experience that he came up with the idea of paperless post.
What were you doing at the time that also was leading you in the direction of wanting to start an online business?
There are a lot of other thoughts that went into doing this kind of company. One of them is that I was working at an older media company, and I was noticing the difficulties that they were having monetizing their content online. It seemed like a really, really big, scary thing for a lot of people and an opportunity for young people who were looking for an opportunity to be creative and solve a problem that the world needed.
You mentioned you had been working for a traditional older media company. That's CBS. You were Katie Kirk's assistant.
Yes.
How did you get that job?
I had worked with her at the Olympics in Athens in 2004. And the reason I got that job was because I speak Greek and read and write Greek because my mom's family is Greek American. So it was all very roundabout how I ended up there.
When you were at CBS, you did receive a lot of invitations in the mail. Did that influence your thinking that, you know what, maybe this could work?
We did receive a lot of invitations at CBS for Katie. But one of the interesting things was that if people were trying to follow up, they would always do it by email. So it meant that essentially for any invitation, there also had to be a digital version. So all of a sudden, it seemed as though the print version was sort of a formality.
Your brother was very specific about his idea, and he is somewhat of an artist. What is his background in the artistic area?
He's entirely self-taught in terms of visual design and graphic design. His entire life, he's been practicing art. So he was a photographer, he was a painter, coin collector, stamp collector, sculptor. And I remember seeing other people's reaction to the things that he would make. And it would be things that he would make in his room. But I remember seeing my mother's friends at our house and always having the same kind of reaction, being impressed. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I also thought about when he was telling me about this idea.
Your mom is from Greece.
From Greece via Pennsylvania.
Okay. And how about your father?
My father's from New York City.
What did your parents do? What do your parents do?
My parents are both lawyers. Mm-hmm. And my dad now practices real estate. And my mom is actually a in-house counsel at Paperless Post.
You mentioned that your mom is Greek and that you speak Greek. Do you speak any other languages?
Yeah, languages were the thing that I was that made me most interested in school initially. So I speak and read and write modern Greek, and I speak Spanish, and I also know Latin and ancient Greek as well from school.
How do you think that's informed any of this?
I think it's informed a lot of it because I am really interested in the programming languages that we use, and I've learned enough about each of each of them to understand what I need to know about how they're used, and that makes my job really fun.
When you say programming languages, you're talking about computer programming languages, the plumbing that goes on behind what you see.
That's right. It's what makes it all work.
Because ultimately, it seems like, as well as being a design-oriented company, Paperless Post is a technology company.
Yeah, and more of that, half the people that work at Paperless Post are software developers.
You were 23 years old when you launched the company, and your brother was 21. How did that help or hurt?
So somebody told us once that one of the things you learn when you start a company is that everything that you think is going to be easy is really hard and takes a really long time. And everything that you think is going to be hard is really hard and takes a really long time. And one of the benefits to being a really young person with very little experience when you start a company is that you really do not have much fear about what's going to go into it. And you have the energy to stay up all night. And you have the fearlessness to write somebody that's more senior than you and ask them to work at your company.
Who was one of the people you wrote letters to, senior executives?
I think it wasn't as much senior executives. Mm-hmm. It was more people that knew things that we didn't know, like very, very good software developers. There's a very important technical culture at our company, and that was really founded and cultivated by Aaron Quint, who is our CTO. And in the beginning, he contracted with Paperless Post, and he really wasn't going to come on and work full-time because he had a really great career contracting. And so hiring people that were really different from us and not being scared to ask them to come work with us, and the fact that we were all young, he's also my age, was definitely a benefit in terms of building the company.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that enables users to email custom-made stationery that wouldn't typically be sent over the internet. Users range from individuals to institutions like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the National Gallery. So you had this moment where you thought, okay, we're gonna give this a try. Your brother was still in college, and you were still working as Katie Couric's assistant. What happened then?
What happened was that it was a process of working backwards from the end product that James had defined, the unit of which was a card that was customized. We worked backwards to understand how you would have that be sent over the internet. We quickly realized that it would be via a design process that a user would be in control of, which meant that we needed to create a tool online that would enable a user to create that end product. On nights and weekends, we would meet with a lot of different people, and we would also spend a lot of alone time in our parents' house, or when he was at school and I was living at my parents' house, laying out and designing what we could do. And for him, that was the card and the cards and the format of the end product. And for me, it was the user interface that would enable users to design those cards.
How did you raise capital in the early days? And how much capital did you need early on if it was just you and your brother?
We didn't raise capital until we launched in 2009. We were able to raise capital because we had traction, because we had users, not because we were telling a story about a future when we would have a product and have users.
Once you launched the site, what were the first invitations you sent out, and how did you get traction initially?
Well, we never sent out invitations. So what happened was that there were people that knew what we were doing and asked us when they could use it. And so I had said to a friend that she could use it by September 30th, and she kept bugging me about using it. She kept bugging me, and finally I gave her a password, and I didn't think she'd be able to use the product or navigate through it. And then she gave me a call a few hours later, and she said, "So did you see what I made?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "No, I didn't see what you made." And she said, Well, can you just go on the site and log on and look at this invitation? Do you like the font color I chose? Do you like the font I chose? Do you like this? I thought it was really great that I chose that champagne bottle. And so she ended up sending that invitation to, 200 or 220 people. And honestly, there is no other way to describe how people started using paperless post other than that party.
What was the party for?
For her 22nd birthday.
One of your board members is Ram Shri Ram, who was an early investor in Google. How did you meet him?
We actually didn't meet Ram personally. He received an invitation or multiple invitations, and so he ended up going to the homepage of Paperless Post and reading about the About Us and then maybe doing a little more Googling about us and then wrote us a really warm email to, I think, to our help email. We wrote him back and we ended up having breakfast with him in New York City.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital stationery. Paperless Post makes money by selling virtual coins for customizing its cards, and the company became profitable in 2010. Your chief operating officer, Lucy Grayson, helped you define the strategy and the business model for the company. How exactly was she helpful, and how do you make money?
I'd say she's been extremely helpful because she came in and helped us define who we were as a business, not just as a product. By her asking, we had to think really hard about how were we going to make money, and a lot of the options didn't fit with the product we'd created because having ads would have meant interjecting between two people's communication. My brother made the comment in a New York Times article that you would never have a flyer in a wedding invitation, so why would you have an ad on an online wedding invitation? And by April of 2009, we deployed a direct-to-consumer payment model. So I credit Lucy's involvement greatly with our self-definition as a business.
What were some stumbling blocks for you in the early days? You were fortunate in that you had a clear concept for the company and that you got traction pretty immediately. What was harder for you than you thought?
Every business that you create, there's also a lot of things that happen behind the scenes. We did learn along the way that there were a lot of other things a business required to succeed, such as email deliverability, which is one of the most detail-oriented and difficult sets of rules to learn, but James somehow became our in-house email deliverability expert
guru.
I remember Lucy saying early on when James was on a call about email deliverability, she was like, "Thank you for caring so much." And it was true. It's just out of pure care to learn something like email deliverability, and a lot of things that are not pretty go into creating an actual company.
Paperless Post offers a platform for design partners, ranging from large companies like Crane and Boatman Geller to boutique stationers. But it wasn't always that way. You didn't always have these outsourcing design partners. What were some of the first designs that you and your brother came up with?
One of the first ones was called Saint-Germain, and it was a cream rectangular invitation that had a gold bevel and rounded corners, and it just had a simple script font, and it was extremely formal and actually probably not financially viable to send with paper, but that and a few other invitations, one had a silk black ribbon, and it was sort of a shimmery silver paper stock. That was also very popular. Basically, we started out with this line that was extremely formal, and the interesting thing was that when users saw Paperless Post in the beginning, they just felt that that meant that they could use us for formal things, so they started using us for things like, you know, engagement parties or rehearsal dinners and later on actual weddings. And that wasn't really a core part of our plan, but it was amazing that that happened as a result of the type of cards that we originally started with.
You mentioned, you know, silk shimmery paper stock and liners. Now, we have to remember this is all virtual. What are some other designs you came up with?
One of the famous cards that we started out with was red, and it had black and white zebras jumping across the border, and it was based off of a wallpaper at an Italian restaurant in Midtown called Gino's, which I think is sadly now closed.
On Lexington Avenue in New York City. Paperless Post is effectively making stationery more affordable using a digital medium. For instance, you have a calligrapher named Bernard Meisner, who in the real world, his artwork and his actual cards are very expensive.
Bernard Meisner is one of the best calligraphers in the world. One of the wonderful things about having these design partners was that we could have people like Bernard Meisner, whose cards are normally at the mid-range, $6 per item, allow that type of design to be accessed by people who would not otherwise be able to afford to use it. And basically the reason for that is that we are only offering the design itself and the visual quality and not the cost of producing it in physical form.
You mentioned $6 per item. Do you mean per letter?
Yes.
Who is another artist, designer, that's offered on the site whom you particularly like?
Mr. Boddington is a line that is on Paperless Post. It's a sub-brand of Mr. Boddington, which is an offline artisanal stationer in New York City. The sub-brand is Mr. Boddington's Nephew, and it's been incredibly popular.
What does it look like?
It is colorful. It's witty. There's often hand-driven fonts on the cards, and it has its own very distinctive brand. There are colors that are regularly used, like pink and yellow and orange, and you know that it's Mr. Boddington when you see it. It's a really great sort of auger for the future of these design partnerships that we have, because we're actually being able to share a lot of revenue with these really talented designers and offer them a platform to get exposure to lots of visitors.
What was the last invitation you sent?
The last invitation I sent was a Chinese New Year invitation. It was for a dinner party that I'm having tonight. And it was on a card that looks like a gold coin, and it flips, and then there is sort of a witty joke, and then an invitation to dinner at 9.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.